Hello, this is Ideas and Issues, and I'm your host, Hugh LaFollette. My guest today is Ariel Gluklich, professor of theology at Georgetown University, and we're discussing his book, Sacred Pain, Hurting the Body for the Sake of the Soul. Ariel, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Perhaps the easiest way to begin is to ask you if you could give the listener a brief synopsis of the central thesis of Sacred Pain.
Sure, absolutely. What I try to do in this book is show that the intentional and conscious application of pain to oneself, to one's own body, has a number of effects. Some of them are very beneficial. First of all, it brings about a change of consciousness that can be very profound. Linked with that is a change of identity. And when these two factors are coupled with appropriate beliefs, for example, a belief that there's a greater center of being than one's individual ego, all of these combined produce highly profound religious experiences, such as a sense of merging with God, a sense of being healed spiritually, or a sense of passing from a lower state of being to a higher state of being, and so forth. So all of these factors end up resulting in beneficial, spiritually beneficial experience. And what I try to do in the book is, first of all, develop a neurological theory, or draw on other neurological theories to explain how that works, and secondly, show the context in which these processes take place in the religious life.
One of the things that might be helpful, you mention in the book that certainly people who are not religious might find this idea very unusual. But the fact is, many religious people, at least within certain traditions, might also find the idea very unusual. I know, for instance, many of my students here would find the idea of inflicting pain upon oneself, the idea that that could have some sort of religious purpose is very foreign to them. Wonder if you could just at least briefly address that, why so many people perhaps in Western society don't see that this idea of sacred pain has some long history within religion.
Well, without a doubt, today in America, this ritual and ideological use of pain has gone out. You can still go to many places around the world where it's quite pervasive. For instance, in pilgrimages, India, for example, where pilgrimages can be extremely painful, walking barefoot on very hot terrain, with a very clear sense that if you put on your shoes, then the pilgrimage isn't as beneficial. So there are examples around the world where pain is still used. The reason I suspect that it's not used and it's not familiar in America is that after 150 years or so of anesthetics and various pain medications, we've simply come to accept the fact that our body should not hurt, that pain is not part of the equation of what the good life feels like, including religion. And so we've lost track of the fact that previously pain was taken for granted as a part of natural existence, and therefore in the religious context as well, it could be used and even emphasized.
Okay, that's helpful, though I would like maybe a little bit later in the show to come back and talk about that a bit more. In your first answer, you talked about a little bit about the basic thesis that pain can have very valuable benefits, and you briefly explained what those are. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit more. Specifically, I know you talk a great deal in your book about the way in which it can change a person's understanding of their identity. So I wonder if you could talk about both generally how that might happen, and we'll look a little bit later at the neurological basis, but also what its significance might be.
I think that the best way to get at the sorts of benefits that are attributed to pain in religious life is to look at the models in which this pain is articulated. For example, when a religious text talks about pain as healing or pain as medicine. What they're saying is that religious individuals experiencing pain are removing the way, say, a surgeon might remove something which is worse than the pain. What that something might be could be guilt, or it could, guilt as a result of having sinned. Or it could be anxiety, very profound anxiety, and that anxiety might be attributed to a belief in hell. So if you know with certainty that you haven't been a very good person, because nobody really is, and you also know with some certainty that you're going to hell, then you want to find a way to heal, to remedy that anxiety. And pain in this life has a way of doing that. So the pain as medicine model would deal with that. There's also pain as a chemical agent, something that purifies oneself. In the same way that around the world there have been a variety of magical rituals to heal different illnesses, for example, various coughs are treated, or asthma are treated by pulling patients through narrow holes or passages in trees and rocks and caves and so forth, a sort of a scraping of spiritual crud. So pain, too, has the effect of almost alchemically removing unwanted accretion to the spirit. So that's another way of conceptualizing it. The benefits are always within the realm of how religious individuals speak about the pain, rather than the way a biomedical theorist would account for the benefit of pain. In order to get at that level of explanation, you have to look at the neurological function.
Well, in fact, maybe you could begin there and talk a little bit about the neurological explanation of the phenomenon you're talking about. Though perhaps a prefatory to that, if you could briefly explain exactly what you mean by pain.
Okay, I take roughly the way the International Association of Pain or the American Medical Association define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience, which is usually but not always associated with damage to tissue, body tissue. So it's an aversive sensation rather than, for example, suffering, which is something that could be brought about through the loss of a child or a parent or something like that. So I take pain in a rather commonsensical way as hurting in the body, although it's not always precisely in the body. And then the way all of this operates, and this is all hypothetical and theoretical, it's based on my readings of the latest pain research, particularly Ronald Melzack, who's a neuropsychologist from Canada. It works something along these lines, a cybernetic type of mechanism at work. Imagine that you go into a sensory deprivation tank in which there's absolutely no sensory input coming in. When you float there and there's no sound, nothing to see, and so forth, before long, the brain output becomes greatly enhanced. So you start having these delusions, visions, which are very, very vivid and very real. The absence of input produces or yields a greater output. The flip side of that is that if the system is bombarded through sensory input, the output becomes diminished. Now, the center, the controlling center for both input and output, according to Melzack, is something that he calls a neuromatrix, which has a functional aspect that he calls neurosignature. And basically what that means is that input is governed by the nervous system according to certain experiential modality. It's a kind of a very up-to-date, I suppose, Kantian reading of the brain functioning. So what happens is when you hurt the body, it doesn't have to be very deep and excruciating pain, but it has to be something noticeable to the system, then the output begins to diminish. And if the hurting is thorough enough, then there's a decreasing sense of being an agent, decreasing sense of being a self that yields certain intentions, certain control functions, and so forth and so on. It sounds awfully abstract, but what it boils down to is that the self, the agent, gradually dissolves as you hurt yourself. Now, that does not mean that you forget everything that you knew, everything that you learned. If you're a good Christian and you were brought up with certain dogmas and beliefs and so forth, these things do not disappear when you hurt yourself in a cell, in a monastic cell. Instead, what happens is there's a disappearance of the individual self who holds these beliefs, and the beliefs start to gain a certain level of autonomy, and they are enhanced. And that, under the right circumstances, can lead to a sense of identification with those things that you believe, so that if you believe that the dying Christ on the cross is profoundly salvific, then in hurting yourself, you're not, strictly speaking, imitating Christ. You are, experientially speaking, becoming Christ on the cross. You actually become identified experientially with the suffering Christ. So that would be one example of that.
Okay, so the presence of pain, at least a significant amount of pain, a noticeable amount of pain, can make one lose one's sense of identity as an individual self, and then one begins to concentrate more upon, at least in the appropriate context, upon the proper or appropriate beliefs, and if one is religious, the appropriate religious beliefs. And those beliefs become more vivid, more profound, more moving than they would have been before.
That's correct. The critical factor is that it has to be voluntary. If you take somebody against his will, tie him down and torture him, slash his skin, whatever, that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. I mean, perhaps this is jumping the gun a little bit.
Okay.
But presumably, if someone else inflicts the pain upon you, you may come to see the pain in the same sort of way as if you'd inflicted it upon yourself. And in that sense, it might be voluntary.
Yes. If you are being hurt by somebody else, but that is done in a ritual context, then the ritual compensates for the fact that you're not hurting yourself. But if you are, say, the victim of the Argentinian police during the Dirty War, they strap you to a chair somewhere and torture you, there won't be any kind of benefits. Although it does result in states of depersonalization, disassociation, and other very profound psychological states. So that can happen. Part of the neurological things do happen, but the religious do not.
You've used the term ritual here several times, and it seems to me that plays a pretty important role. I wonder if you could explain exactly what you mean by a ritual, especially a religious ritual, and why that's so important for understanding how pain, which initially is simply seen as aversive, could have this positive, beneficial effect.
Okay, the way I'm using ritual here is as a choreographed and socially affirmed series of events or actions in which the participants are, to varying degree, voluntary. Now, obviously, it's easy to think of rituals in which certain participants are not voluntary participants. If you think of an 8-day-old boy, Jewish boy, who's having circumcision, then he is part of the ritual. The whole procedure is ritualized. If it is not done in the hospital by a surgeon or a urologist, but instead it's being done in a sacred context with the rabbi and the mohel and so forth, that makes it a ritual. But either way, the little child, the infant, is not a participant. So there are certain kinds of rituals that are problematic, and I do have to deal with that kind of a problem. But by and large, most rituals involve participants who are voluntary and conscious participants in the various steps and procedures of the ritual.
How particularly does this ritual change the experience of pain into something, again, that's just aversive, into something which has or provides or offers or leads to religious insight?
Okay. In cases where all participants in the ritual agree to participate in the ritual, that is, they are conscious participants in the ritual, and that can even take place in, say, cases of execution. Foucault describes one in one of the chapters. I talk about that, in which a man who has killed the king is being executed, a very prolonged execution. Obviously, he'd rather be home or away. He does not want to be there. Okay, but now the execution is not a swift beheading or what have you. Instead, it is very carefully choreographed, and it's got hundreds of parts and steps. Every now and then, a priest would walk over to the man and ask him, how do you feel, and what have you to say, and are you thinking about God? And he responds to that, and then the priest walks away. So there are all these stages of the performance, and that's what turns it from a just mere execution into a ritualized spectacle. Now, the victim does not want to be executed. That part, he is involuntary. But in as much as the whole thing is ritualized, and every time the priest approaches him, he says something meaningful, he is a participant of that aspect. And when he becomes a participant in that aspect of the proceedings, then it is not just a gruesome application of force by the state on the victim. Instead, it becomes something rather salvific. It's something like this. The state is saying to this man, to this victim, we're giving you an opportunity to save your soul. This pain here now is going to prevent far greater pains for you in hell for the horrible things that you did. So rituals give the hurting subject an opportunity to reflect on why he is being hurt in the ritual context. And in as much as that happens and the victim appropriates the reasons for the infliction of the pain, then it becomes beneficial. If it's just a gruesome crushing of an individual, then nothing beneficial happens.
Are all rituals beneficial on your account?
You mean in the sense of being beneficial to the individual who's being hurt?
At least that, yes.
Yeah. No. No, I think that this kind of theory that I'm positing here has grades or gradation. For example, if an individual is, this is something that's known, an example from China, a woman who's accused of adultery, convicted of adultery, and is executed by means of the 1,000 slices of gruesome mutilation and so forth, in which she is partially drugged, but she suffers enormously, and it is ritualized. I see absolutely no benefit to anyone there whatsoever, and I think it's easy to come up with other examples like that. And that's obviously an extreme example of a gruesome ritual that has absolutely no benefit. It's possible to go to the middle place, the gray place, where the pain isn't so gruesome and the benefit, well, maybe there's some benefit, but it's a graded thing.
So at least what you'd want to say then is ritual changes what's being done. It may not always justify it, but at least injects new factors which we ought to look at if we're going to decide if it's appropriate or inappropriate.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay, I'd like to turn now and look at the three examples that you look at some detail in your book. The three examples in particular are possession, rites of passage, and a look at the Inquisition. I wonder if you could say a little bit about each of those, what you mean by them and why they seem to be so significant or important within certain religious traditions.
Okay, I'll start with possession. The reason I'm interested in possession for this book is that, first of all, I've done quite a bit of field work in India with possessed individuals, and I find that there's a very strong correlation between being possessed and being in pain, or at least between hurting as a triggering event and then being possessed. And what I mean by possession is the sense of having either another person or entity in your body. It could be a ghost, it could be the spirit of a dead relative, it could be a demon, it could be God. And very often I find that this sense of being either someone else or having someone else in you is perpetuated by acts of self-mutilation and hurting. The most common one that I saw being the repeated banging of one's forehead on the ground. But I also saw tearing hair out and slashing at oneself with fingernails and so forth. So what I'm interested in here is the way that various cultures capitalize on this phenomenon in order to produce desired types of religious events, becoming possessed with the spirit of God, becoming possessed with some kind of spirit that allows you to forecast the future or resolve disputes or heal if you are a shaman, and so forth. Now, exorcism as well very often involves the use of pain. The reason I'm interested in possession and exorcism before Passage and the Inquisition is because I regard it as a fairly elementary social context in which the neurodynamics that I talked about before take place. The next level of analysis, Passage, is more elaborate in that rites of passage involves so many other kinds of dynamics and processes aside from the use of pain. But they're interesting to me because Passage involves also a change of identity, a change of social status from, say, a child to an adult, from an adult to a warrior, from a young woman to a married woman, and so forth and so on. But it's not just a change of social identity. It's also a change of experiential identity, at least in theory. So here what I'm looking at is, again, what are the changes that are brought about directly by the use of pain in these ritual contexts? And the single ritual that I look at in greatest detail is the sun dance, which is a Plains Indian phenomenon, which is still quite widely practiced in America today. And it involves a three-day dance around a central pole, followed after 3 days by piercing in the chest muscles and inserting the insertion of hooks there, and then being tied to the pole with a rope. You continue to dance, but at the end of the dance, and obviously this is very painful at this point, but it gets even more, you have to run away from the pole and tear the hooks out of the flesh. Very painful. And I'm interested in what the participants think or feel the pain does for them. And their personal narratives are always about sacrifice, about love, about bond with the people around them, their families, the community, and so forth. So to them, as far as they are concerned, the pain of this mutilation is a very beneficial one. The third context, the one in which I talk about the Inquisition, is the most abstract of these three, because here we're taking a victim, somebody who was a questionable member of the Christian community in Spain or in medieval Europe, and we are, in a sense, ramming down the identity of a good Christian into their throat. So that seems like it would be the most difficult case to prove of all. How can one call the Inquisition a beneficial use of pain? But I find here, too, that the Inquisition does not set out to crush its victim, to just brutalize them the way, say, the Gestapo did with its victims. Instead, what it tries to do is modulate the pain to correspond with the changing sense of self of the victim who is strapped to the various torture implements. So you're not crushing bones and breaking bones and doing things like that. You're increasing pain according to a very carefully orchestrated choreography. I call it sort of rough psychoanalysis, where the examiner, the inquisitor, who, by the way, is not directly inflicting the pain, is sort of like the analyst. And what goes on in the give and take between the torturer and the victim is a fairly refined procedure designed not to crush a man or a woman, but to turn them into a good Christians. So it's a bit of a stretch, but I feel that it's a case that could be made.
Okay, we only have a couple of minutes left here. I'm partly because I can imagine the listener out there wondering the same thing. Sometimes when you describe this, you sound as if you are wanting to justify the Inquisition or justify all the rituals of passage. And yet there are certainly other places in the book where you say things which indicate that you're not trying to justify them at all. You're simply trying to put us in a position where we can better understand them. What actually is your approach?
Okay. My own approach is that religious rituals of any kind, especially the ones that use pain, are not justifiable in the sense that I question them on certain moral grounds. But what I am trying to do here is this. I'm trying to, through understanding these particular rituals and the rationale behind the rituals, I'm trying to understand what they felt, both ideologically and physically, what they felt to be the benefits of these rituals, and to learn that. And I feel that by learning that, I can bring some very valuable knowledge to people today, chronic pain patients, lots of those, who are trying to understand their pain in a certain kind of almost cosmological context. You know, a lot of chronic pain patients want to understand their pain. They don't want to just get better. A lot of them have given up on getting better. They want to understand the context of their pain. Why do I hurt? What is the meaning of my hurt? And I feel that if one can understand the ritual uses of pain, the religious uses of pain, one can also help the chronic pain patient differentiate between his or her physical sufferings and the context or the ideological context in which these physical sufferings take place. And once you understand these things, I suspect that the actual physical pain becomes diminished, although it's obviously not even remotely a cure for pain. It's a cure for some of the intellectual and spiritual confusion that comes with pain.
All right. Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show today.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking today with Ariel Gluklich, professor of theology at Georgetown University. This is Eula Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.